Welcome to episode 20 of Girls on Pop. I am your host, Brain Antunes.
And I am Ashley Lynch.
We're here to talk stuff. I was very fired up when I saw this story, and I don't even know why, because it's not even like it's new news.
Oh, but I know why.
I have feelings.
This was a story for you.
Was it really? You think so?
I think so.
So,
because you're very attached to this movie.
I am very attached to this movie, and I have issues now because I really like Denis Villeneuve, but he's really rubbing me the wrong way in many ways. Mm. And I'm starting to think of him as like a... let's not even go there. But let's talk about what he did talk about. So he did an interview for Total Film a couple weeks back, and it's finally starting to make the rounds. And I haven't read the full interview because I think it's only available in the print edition of Total Film. But their online version did have a rundown of some of the key takeaways from that conversation, which then got picked up by everybody because Denis said some really kind of stupid things. I mean... I guess the conversation, and you're right, it is kind of made for me in a way because I am rather attached to this property. And I guess the thing that, and we've talked about this before even on the show, this mentality of certain filmmakers that their movies can only be seen on the big screen and that they were made for the big screen and they're upset because it's not on the big screen, or they're, you know, they feel like they've been wronged by the fact that it's day and date.
Let's bring in the quote here.
Yes.
So the quote from Denis Villeneuve is, "First of all, the enemy of cinema is the pandemic. That's the thing. We understand that the cinema industry is under tremendous pressure right now. That I get. The way it happened, I'm still not happy. Frankly, to watch Dune on television, the best way I can compare it is to drive a speedboat in a bathtub. For me, it's ridiculous. It's a movie that has been a tribute to the big screen experience." So that's the quote.
And I mean, the thing that comes to mind, that came to mind as soon as I read that was, okay, I understand you're upset. It's not like they're not showing the movie on the big screen. They're just giving people options of how they want to see it. The thing that bothers me that I think is short-sighted and like, that I didn't really think about when this conversation started, but that has become more and more prevalent as the conversation continues about, you know, day and date and what the future of cinema looks like and will movies in a theater ever really be a thing. The reality of it is movies in a theater are always going to be a thing. Like, they're never going to fully die. They might be a thing that maybe the relationship between the viewer and the films are going to be different going forward, but we're always going to have theaters. We're always going to have the big theater experience. I don't know how this is being overshadowed as the fact that the reality of thing is that movies have mostly lived on home video. Most people don't watch movies in the theater. They will watch a movie 10 years down the line, probably at home, either on TV or on a DVD or on a Blu-ray or whatever. How have we like completely overlooked this? So you're telling me that now I can never watch Dune because, well, I'm never going to get the full experience if I watch it at home?
Well, he's saying you can watch it. You're just going to be driving a speedboat in a bathtub.
Which is what, like impossible?
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know.
Which my response was, you know, it's all bathtubs, it's just different size bathtubs.
That's right. You know? Hey, that's great. That's
or to quote Jaws, and I don't even know if this makes sense or not, but I like it, is it's only an island if you look at it from the water.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Yeah. But I don't know. It's sort of sparked up this conversation again, and I don't know if it was specifically responding to this, but James Gunn also sort of weighed in on the whole idea of, and I think it's just prevalent because all these big movies are getting day and date home video streaming releases too because of the pandemic, and, you know, and also let's face it, the situation with streaming platforms wanting to push why you should subscribe to their platform. And James Gunn had that happen. Suicide Squad came out on HBO Max day and date, same day as the theater. So, and his response was basically that movies last because you can see them on TV. And he talked about how some of his favorite movies he saw, he never saw them in the theater. And same for me. I'm a child of the 80s. You know, I saw a lot of movies in the theater. But there were also a lot of movies that I either wasn't old enough to or didn't get a chance to. And as home video started to become a thing, I still remember when my parents brought home our first VCR and going to a video store with 200 titles because that's all that was available at that time on Beta and VHS. And suddenly, for the first time, with the exception of them releasing a TV version of the movie, movies were accessible in the home. And this became the standard. And now it's like we have access to anything we want. If I want it, chances are I can find it on a streaming platform and watch it. There's still a lot of movies that are sadly not available and you have to really hunt for it. But for the large part, we're living in an age of cinematic decadence for the level of availability that we have to films. And not only that, but let's face it, my home theater setup is comparable to some small theaters. I maybe don't have like a giant theatrical screen, but I've got an 80-inch 4K TV with HDR. You know, I've got a 7.1 surround sound system. I have a movie theater popcorn machine in my house. I can replicate the home theater experience pretty damn well, especially compared to when it was the 80s. And you simply could not get that. So I think it's becoming less and less of a valid argument. And it's also just for the, I mean, I'm old, but for a younger generation, they're having a different relationship with how they watch movies. Like, I will never understand people who decide, yeah, I'm going to watch a movie on my phone. That's just too small a screen for me. I can do iPad, but phone is just way too small. At that point, why am I even watching it? You know, but a lot of kids, they'll watch it on their phones. Hell, they'll watch it inside Fortnite. You know, it's, and you just kind of have to accept that the evolving generations are going to consume this stuff in their own way. And ultimately, you want them watching your film. You don't want them dismissing your film and avoiding it because you're an old man saying, get off my lawn.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, and the reality of it is some of the movies that I have the closest affinity to are movies that I discovered on home video that I later watched in a theater in like a revival screening. I never saw the first Dune in person in a theater when I was like three or whatever I was, however old I was when it came out. I mean, I have seen it theatrically many years later, but I mean, I fell in love with that movie because I watched it on some, you know, I caught half of it on a TV somewhere at some point and then went searching for it. So I'm with you. I think you nailed it. The old man get off my lawn is like the best thing I could possibly imagine because that's exactly what it feels like. I'm sorry, movies are not just for you.
Yeah. I quoted Jaws earlier. It's like one of my favorite movies. I think it's a damn near perfect movie. I never saw it in the theater. My first time seeing it was on VHS. And it was also a horribly presented version, too. They didn't even do a pan and scan of it. They just straight center cropped it, which meant, and because it's like a wide movie, it meant that there were entire scenes of two characters talking to each other, and they weren't even on screen. I was watching a boat bob up and down while Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider are talking to each other. It's like, this is like an art film.
Dude, I had a friend over the other day and we rewatched a couple of 80s movies. It was the first time that she'd seen them. So we saw, I have a new version of Top Gun in 4K that I hadn't watched yet. So we watched that. And then we watched Lost Boys. And I still have, my DVD copy of Lost Boys is still like the flip kind where on one side it's the,
oh God,
the widescreen and on the other side, yeah, it's the box cut. And I accidentally put in the box cut. And she's like, what is this? I'm like, before there were DVDs, most of the time, this is what you got. The square cut TV.
I love that that is foreign to us now because many years ago, I owned a small chain of video stores. And this is
what?
I did. And when DVD was first coming out, and that was my big thing, was like I carried only DVD. I didn't carry any VHS, and that worked out for me in the long run. But it was hard to educate customers on why they were actually not getting less movie because black bars were at the top and bottom of the screen. That was an uphill battle.
Oh, man.
And I'm glad that that is no longer a battle.
Oh, I tell you, what a thing. What a thing. I love it. Jeez. I had a cop. I might still have a copy, a DVD copy of Heat from when it came out, that it's like it was too big to fit on one side of the disc, so you had to flip the disc partway through.
No, those were the worst. I hated the flippers.
I still have.
I'm glad we solved that one.
Me too, but I think I still have it as like, yes, this thing existed, and I've got it.
Yeah. I mean, it's better than in the VHS days when you like get Titanic and it came on two videotapes.
Get up halfway through and actually switch the tape.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Don't forget to rewind the first tape first, though.
Yes.
All right. So that's the Denis news. The other thing that came up, which we've also talked about before, but I thought it was interesting of where it showed up. And there was an article in Variety title, "When Fandom Stopped Playing Nice." And it's all about toxic fandom and how, well, it hasn't been resolved and how the studios are and aren't dealing with it, which I thought was an interesting read. It's not new, and we've talked about it in the past as well. I just thought it was kind of interesting that it's...
Yeah, this was in Vanity Fair.
Yeah, it's entered the mainstream. I don't really have anything more to say about that other than, wow, it's so bad that it's now in mainstream media.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like I'm probably just going to be repeating myself from what I've said past episodes, but, you know, depending on whether or not people have heard my rants, it may or may not be new to them. But yeah, I think it's a problem. And I think it's a much deeper problem than just there's some shitty fandoms out there. And the studios have not done a good job at not capitulating to them. And it's pretty much because they're very good at basically co-opting the same sort of strategy that Gamergate used to sort of present a small number of people as if it is a much larger, seemingly vocal majority, when it is anything but. And when, you know, whether or not you like Zack Snyder's director's cut of Justice League is completely independent of the fact that Warner Brothers caving to a long-running harassment campaign to get that movie made is only going to be detrimental for the future of this, because it just shows, okay, that works. So now it's not, we go away, we got what we want. No, it's doubled down.
Now, and I mean,
the haircut, and now it's like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like you say, it reared its ugly head. Like almost immediately, there started to be new cut this, cut that, and then there's the stupid haircut situation, which is.
And the worst thing that we could ever have is any segment of fandom or the audience, but particularly this bitchy segment of fandom, which doesn't even seem to like the things that they say they're fans of, dictating what can and cannot be made. Because especially when it comes to, and this gets to what is the deeper problem, and it's the fact that we have moved away from making films that are artist-driven. And that sounds more altruistic than I really mean. But what I really mean is just like a celebrity-based culture for filmmaking. And into a corporate-owned intellectual property adaptation market, which means now that everything is Batman, everything is Spider-Man, everything is Sherlock Holmes, everything is something that was something else. And as a result, what they're trying to tap into is the pre-existing fandom. And so you have fandoms that exist entirely within the Star Wars universe that are all about trying to browbeat Disney into making the version of Star Wars that they want to see.
Yeah.
And when it's adapted material, there are people who have what a friend of mine calls fan casting. And he sort of like brings that, or sorry, fan booking, he calls it. And he sort of brings that over from the wrestling world, where people will basically have in their head what they want to see, the stories that they want to be told. And when they don't get that, they criticize and get angry at the movie for not giving them what they wanted, because that was their expectation. But it's a completely unreasonable expectation, because they are not there for the story that they're being told. They're there for the story they want to be told. And that's almost never going to line up. It's a recipe for disappointment every time. And you see this more and more, people getting upset at or critical of a movie for not being what they wanted it to be. And I think this is a symptom of the fact that it's all just intellectual property now. It's all just like corporate-owned IP. And I until we get out of that, and I don't know how we get out of that, or if we will get out of that, I don't know that this goes away or gets better.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I mean, it's disappointing. It's been brewing for years. I mean, we've seen the I don't know if it's both the appetite or the market, or if it's one feeding the other. It feels like it's kind of like this snake biting its own tail, because the reality of it is that middle range, like $30, $40 million adult movie is kind of gone. That market has disappeared. And it's not because the audience is gone, I don't think. Because I mean, I think I'm in that audience, and I know other people are in that audience. And clearly when those movies come out, they tend to make a little bit of money, but they're not making the giant box office that, you know, the big blockbusters do. But I mean, it's like the audience isn't there because the movies aren't there. So the studio's like, well, we're not making enough money, so let's not make those movies anymore. So I mean, the whole thing just kind of like falls apart. And I always felt like the most interesting movies were kind of in that price range. And when those disappear, the whole thing just starts to fall apart. So what you're left with are the awards contenders that come out all at the end of the year, and then the big tentpoles, and nothing in between for anybody else. The whole thing to me, and I mean, those movies are there, they're just not...
They don't get widely released.
Yeah, and they're harder to find.
Yeah, you actually have to look for them. But yeah. It's like, I have this conversation with people a lot when they say, oh, there's nothing but superhero movies. And when you go down the list of like released movies every year, superhero movies are actually, you know, in the minority. There's only so many of them they can make before it just cannibalizes itself. Yep. Because the business for one is eating into another.
Yeah.
But also, if you look at the movies that are made and released every year, there's an incredible amount of smaller, independent, dramatic films that are released. We are living in a time of unprecedented number of films released every year. There's more films released in 2020, even with the year that it was, than, you know, practically any other time in history. So we are awash in films and content right now. And if you want to find it, all you have to do is look. It's just not going to be like the number one movie at the box office that week.
Yeah. Sadly. But I mean, there are movies out there. And actually, that's a great transition, is it?
Can we talk about some movies?
Let's talk about some movies. Do you want to start? I think you're quite a bit longer than mine, though we do have some overlap.
I swear my list is always longer than yours. I watch too many movies is the message that I'm getting.
No, never. Never.
Or maybe not enough. I don't know.
Never enough as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the big movie I saw, and we already briefly touched on this, but is James Gunn's The Suicide Squad, not to be confused with Suicide Squad, the David Ayer movie from a couple of years ago that is nigh unwatchable. So James Gunn came in and basically got carte blanche after he was in the middle of his little rift with Disney after internet trolls tried to get him fired from Marvel and almost succeeded. And in the interim, DC was like, we want to be in the James Gunn business. What do you want to make? We will make it. And he's like, I want to do a Suicide Squad sequel. He's like, you want to redo it? No, I just want to do a straight sequel. Okay, cool. And this movie slaps. It is so good. So we got Idris Elba. We got John Cena. We got Margot Robbie returning as Harley Quinn. We have Daniela Melchior as Ratcatcher, who I was particularly enamored with. And it's James Gunn doing what he does best, taking a bunch of like disparate weirdos and forcing them to work together. It's like this is like R-rated Guardians of the Galaxy. That's very much what this movie is.
Yeah.
But it has a wicked sense of humor. It earns its R rating. You see, it reminded me very much of earlier James Gunn movie called Super.
Yeah.
If you're going to see people's faces explode, you're going to see, you know, really graphic violence that sort of veers in the out of the action arena and into a horror arena almost. But it's all done with this pitch perfect control of the tone between the dark, between the funny, between the action. Every character actually gets a very compelling arc. I especially loved what they did with Harley Quinn in this movie, where the entire movie basically comes to a stop for her to have this entire romantic subplot that's like, what the hell is happening right now? And it plays out in a way that couldn't have been better.
Agreed.
And if I'm not already sounding hyperbolic about this movie enough, like, I went into this, when I got on this movie, I felt like I needed to have, like, stretched my face muscles a little bit more so I wasn't so sore from smiling the entire time. This, I think, is my favorite superhero movie ever. Of all the superhero movies, I think The Suicide Squad is on the top. And it's just, it's very much like James Gunn gets, like, my particular sense of dark humor. I love horror movies. I love action films. I love superhero movies. And I think this is his best film yet. And I think it's just the perfect combination of tone. And it is so fun.
I agree with you that it definitely feels like the most James Gunn big action movie that you could have possibly hoped for. I mean, it digs deep into his Stroma roots and marries them with his comic book love to, like, do the perfect marriage of the two, yeah. Like you said. I didn't love it quite as much as you did. I don't know why. I think the tone is not perfectly matched to my tastes, but I did really have fun with it. And I think you're right. For me, the best part of this movie was Harley Quinn, and I am still, like, rather shocked that a man was able to write this character in a way that's not condescending and that I didn't want to punch the screen. So, I mean,
I'm guessing she had a significant hand.
I expect so, because it seems to me
Harley Quinn's her baby.
Yeah, and it seems to me like it's just so perfectly matched to the previous versions of the character, at least the Birds of Prey, which for me, I really love that movie on a level that most people don't. But
me too.
This felt like a great, like, continuation of that that version of Harley. So yeah, for me, that was by far the highlight. And
even from Ayer's unwatchable first Suicide Squad movie, it's, you see this wonderful kind of progressional arc in Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn character across those three movies, where in, like, the first movie, she's like still, like, she's thinking about, like, breaking out on her own, but she's still very much tied to the Joker. And then Birds of Prey is her completely severing her relationship with the Joker and trying to figure out how to essentially be an independent woman. And by the end of that movie, she's kind of, like, got her shit together and she's figured it out. And then by the time you get to this movie, you have a Harley Quinn who's like, you know, I promised myself whenever I found an abusive guy that I wasn't going to let him get into my life. And she does it in, like, the most amazing yet comedic way, too.
Yeah.
It's like, I absolutely loved it. You get a full 3-movie arc with this character.
You're so right. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. So, Suicide Squad, awesome fun.
Yeah. And also No. But also unexpected, too.
Yeah.
Like the movie was constantly surprising me. It was constantly catching me off guard with things that I did not think were going to happen. And it's kind of amazing in this day and age that you can watch a superhero movie where, like, oh, crap, I didn't think that was going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am, the only thing that I'm a little bit disappointed of is that they killed a bunch of characters that I actually would have liked to see in a follow-up movie. But this only suggests that there is way more in the well that Gunn can dig into for a next one, because I expect that there probably will be a next one at some
point. I hope so. It's, I don't know, there's a lot of whinging in the trades right now about Suicide Squad underperforming, but honestly, when you look at it compared to everything else that's come out, it's done just fine.
Agreed.
Nothing is doing fantastic in the theater right now, and it's only one part of the
equation. Puzzle. Exactly.
This is where, in the new age where stuff is getting hybrid released, the people who have to write box office roundups must A, be very frustrated themselves, but also B, create articles that are incredibly frustrating because they have one half of the picture. And the streaming platforms are a black box. They don't share that data with everyone, which means when they're trying to decide whether or not a film is a success or a failure in the pages of Deadline, they can't because they only have the box office side of it. They don't have the streaming side of it. And so you're always getting an inaccurate picture. And also, every one of those articles should basically just start with, there's a pandemic on and half the country won't wear masks, so none of this means anything.
And it's worth mentioning because I just listened to it yesterday. On the box office, there was the latest episode of IndieWire's podcast had Ann Thompson speaking with IndieWire's box office predictor guy, whose name I have forgotten, so apologies. But we'll link to the episode in the show notes. And it was really fascinating because he goes into great detail about trying to wrangle numbers for a box office when a box office is basically non-existent. So tying into that discussion we just had, it's totally worth listening to that episode. It's very, very interesting.
I will have to hear that because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's really great. But yeah, Suicide Squad, 2 thumbs up.
Yeah, absolutely. Loved it.
Okay, another
one. And I saw it in the theater. I did not watch it on HBO Max like a lot of people did. I went to a Thursday night screening.
That was me. I watched it at home on my TV. And I still thoroughly enjoyed it.
I've watched it at home since. I've watched the movie 3 times at this point.
Hardcore!
Yeah. I don't know. It's a comforting movie. I'll put it on while I'm working on something else. It's enjoyable.
I have movies like that for sure. Another one, Jungle Cruise.
Yes.
I may have recommended this to a couple of people. I think somebody had texted me like, I watched this the other day. I'm like, then you should watch this because I really enjoy Jungle Cruise. I mean, full admission, it is not great. The visual effects are a little iffy in places, which shocks me considering it's Disney and the amount of money they pumped into this thing. However, Emily Blunt can do no friggin' wrong. She is so good, and I will watch pants in any movie that they give me. just give me pants. She can be like Indiana Jones. Just call her pants, the next adventure. I'll watch it because she's great. I mean, her and Dwayne Johnson have zero chemistry, which is hilarious to me. However, I did rather enjoy the movie. It's just good kind of mindless fun.
So, okay, first of all, the good. Yes, you're right. Emily Blunt is amazing in this movie. And one of the things that I do love about this movie is that she gets a majority of the action beats in this film, not The Rock. No. The Rock is actually kind of like the love interest to her protagonist in this film. And that was unexpected. I like that. I want more of that. That's great. And yes, I love Emily Blunt. I agree with you that they don't have any real chemistry together, but they're both on their own incredibly charming.
Yes.
And their charm is cranked up to 11 here.
Yeah. And I mean, and
so while they're both incredibly watchable and endearing to watch as actors, together they don't really have any chemistry.
No, the banter is great, the banter works, but as far as a spark of romance, it's not there. So when they push that, I'm like, really? This feels awkward.
So I'm going to stick with the good things for now. I really love Jesse Plemons' character. It's this, God, I don't even know how to describe his character, but he's this.
Of course there are Nazis. Come on.
Yeah.
There have to be Nazis.
It, like, I can't remember, was he actually like a legit Nazi?
I think so. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that because I don't think they ever actually mentioned it, but no. He really, like, they're really like telegraphing Indiana Jones here. I mean,
yeah.
He's like, they don't say he's German, but he has a really bad German accent and he's an officer. And there's the whole, you know, the Nazis love things. We're always looking for things that could like put them over the edge, even if they were like supernatural. So I don't think they actually say it now that you mention it, but they're certainly telegraphing it.
Yeah, but he's doing like this really heightened, like
huge
German accent as he's piloting this sub around, and he's just... It essentially plays like the villain or the foil of the movie, or one of them anyways. And he is incredibly entertaining. I've always felt that Jesse Plemons was an underrated actor, and here he really gets to like build a ridiculous character and make it so entertaining.
Yeah, it's very much unlike anything he's... Yeah, and he doesn't play these kinds of characters very often. He's usually like in very like dramatic roles, and he's always really good, but it's nice to see him stretch.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, with that out of the way, I did not enjoy this movie. And maybe the writing was the primary thing, but it's a non-story. I mean, it's a Disney theme park movie, which we've seen them do. They've gotten like, I don't know how many Pirates of the Caribbean movies out of it at this point. But my problem isn't so much that it's a theme park ride movie. It's that they didn't actually try to do anything new with this. The movie is literally just a Pirates of the Caribbean smashed together with Maverick. That's what this movie is. And they were like, I was kind of shocked to see like entire scenes where the plot was just wholesale lifted from Maverick and wholesale lifted from Pirates of the Caribbean. It's like, oh, we get midway through this movie and find out that our swashbuckling hero man is also kind of sort of a ghost and is fighting his former ghost friend. Wait, this is just fucking Pirates of the Caribbean again. You know, it's that became disappointing. And it's not even really subtle about hiding it either. And so when you come across it, it just feels like, you feel like you've been duped. I felt like I was duped watching this movie, and I didn't like that feeling. So ultimately, I did not like Jungle Cruise. No, I really hope this doesn't continue, but I know it will.
Oh, I mean, and that's the thing. It's not by any stretch a good movie. Like, there's so much of it that is so not good. But for me, the Emily Blunt character was really the only thing that saved it. And I would really watch. Actually, there was a French film from a number of years ago that also had like a female archaeologist that was kind of like saving the world. I can't remember what the name of it was now, but I've always wanted to see a continuation of that series. And that this kind of just reminded me that that's what I want to see. I want to see a female Indiana Jones.
I mean,
and I think that's just what I'm craving.
If someone can just finally figure out how to actually make a Tomb Raider movie, we can have that.
Right? Okay, let's get this done, because the iterations...
We're doing our fourth time at the bat. Alicia Vikander's going back for a second run at it, and hopefully they'll make a good one this time, because I love Tomb Raider, but none of the movies are good.
Yeah, no, you are so right. So right. I didn't realize she was coming back, so fingers crossed they managed to get it right.
Yes.
Changing gears a little bit, Woodstock 99.
Yeah. This is a documentary that's on HBO Max, all about the, you know, kind of infamous Woodstock 1999 festival that went. I don't know what you had like previously known about it. I didn't really pay too much attention to it when it happened, but I just remember like all the news stories about how it was a freaking disaster and ended up on the final day there was just like a big fire and a riot, and It was considered one of the most unmitigated disasters in event history.
Yeah, well, when Woodstock 94 happened, I was in like 10th grade, and it was the greatest disappointment of my life that I couldn't go. So when they announced they were going to do Woodstock 99, I quite honestly like looked at flights and tickets and could I make this happen? Because God damn it, I didn't want to miss it again. And then ultimately it just never materialized for me. And in part, it was at a time when festivals were kind of, I mean, in the mid 90s, there have always been festivals, but in the mid 90s, festivals kind of took on a different turn, I feel. And they became a little bit more accessible and something that you could maybe go to if you really wanted to. And I never managed to go to one and I'm still kind of pissed about the whole thing. However, I had followed the drama of Woodstock 99. The thing is that when it was happening, it was before social media was prevalent. So what you caught of Woodstock was basically what you saw in the news, if you happened to be watching the news, or that you read later in the music trades, because that was really the only way to get news. So, yeah. And at the time, I mean, I was, you know, 19 or something. I wasn't watching the news regularly. I was reading music magazines all the time, like consuming them like fucking water. So I remember getting like all the updates of what happened at Woodstock in everything from Rolling Stone to I think it was Guitar World or something. So, I mean, I did kind of see the aftermath, but I never really knew exactly what had happened behind the scenes. So getting this kind of insight was really interesting and also just really fucking sad. And I think what surprised me most, because I watched this shortly after reading an article about the 90s and sort of the aftermath of what came next and the whole like frat boy mentality and the whole thing just makes me wonder, like, how did we ever survive the 2000s? Like,
yeah,
it's scary. I mean, admittedly, I did find the documentary was a little bit one-sided. The filmmakers definitely went in with the mentality that, you know, things went badly wrong. And
I don't think there's any way to get around that.
It's no. Like the thing that I thought was super interesting is that the organizers have like no shame, like no shame whatsoever. It's like, no, well, we were doing the right thing. I'm like, how can you watch this footage and hear yourself talk and not think you did anything wrong? Like, it's so amazing.
You legit have whatever the like in studio stuff was recorded. Let's assume 2020. You have one of the organizers of the festival literally saying, if women got raped, they were asking for it.
Like, in what planet do you even think that? Like, and the fact that they're still talking about maybe we can do another one. It's like, no, just die already. Okay, get lost. Very infuriating. I couldn't believe it. The whole time I was like, oh my God, this is so much worse than I thought.
I was so blown away by this documentary, and I found it so interesting and so educational. I'm going to push back a little bit on the idea that the film is one-sided. Yes, it definitely approaches it with a perspective of like, you know, yeah, shit went wrong. And we all know shit went wrong, but it examines from all sides without placing specific blame on any one thing, and does a really good job at showing how it was like this perfect storm of both predictable and unpredictable elements that only with hindsight can you see would come together to cause this exact thing. Like, not only do you have some of the most piss poor planning for a festival of this size ever, but you've also got an unprecedented heat wave going on at the time, which is driving everyone crazy. You've got basically a lineup of bands that couldn't be better replicated to try to both attract a very specific audience at that very specific time at the end of the 90s to very specifically behave in the way that they did. And I think that's one of the things that the documentary does best is it sort of gets you into what the culture was at the end of the 90s.
Yes, I fully agree.
Even as someone who fully lived through the 90s and has a lot of nostalgia for the 90s. I mean, that was when I was, you know, in my 20s. It was in the 90s, and I have a lot of, it was a very formative period for me, and I have a lot of fond memories of both that period and the culture at that period. And I think I had kind of tuned out or just like tried to like block out some of the more pernicious aspects of the culture at that time that I completely forgotten about. And this documentary reminded me of in particular, and the documentary goes into this, like the massive kind of backlash to feminism that was happening at the time, resulting in a whole cottage industry of like Girls Gone Wild and shit like that, which resulted in an audience that even 5 years earlier at the Woodstock 94, you did not have dudes that were coming into such a pro-misogyny culture as they did at 99. And then you're going to send them in there with bands like Limp Bizkit and Metallica and Red Hot Chili Peppers. And, you know, it's like all the, if you want to rile up a bunch of angry white dudes in their
20s. This is it. This is the place to do it.
Yeah. This is the lineup you do.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's, you see how the makeup of the festival was predominantly like these white 20-year-old frat boy dudes.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually think that that's probably the documentary's strongest point, is the sort of the reminder of what the culture really was like at that point. And I think you're right. It's easy to, as somebody that also grew up in the 90s, I mean, my formative years were the 90s, really. I was a teen at that point. And so like a lot of the music, a lot of the movies that I fall in love with, I discovered during that period of my life. And I agree. I think it's easy to sort of wear the rose colored glasses and remember just the good things and then forget what was so toxic. And the reality of it is that the 90s were, especially towards the end, were really toxic. I mean, just look at the music that on display here and that was like top of the charts at the time. I mean, a lot of it was angry white dudes yelling about shit that, I mean, I could never really relate to. So,
And I think an aspect that doesn't really get sort of focused on enough is the fact that also it was the end of the millennium.
Yeah.
And so you have a level of nihilism that sort of seeps into the culture of like,
there was a lot of panic.
Almost doomerism.
Yeah.
About, holy shit, the end of the world is coming because it's the millennium. Because, of course, what else could, like, the changing of 99 into 2000 be other than complete doom?
Yeah.
And even if no one thought the world was going to, like, blow up when we reached 2000, there was definitely that kind of, it was in the air.
For and sure.
And that nihilism was very much, I think, present all throughout the last few years of the 90s.
Agree. I actually thought that a couple of artists really redeemed themselves for me with some of their interviews. Like, I've always liked Moby, but he's always seemed to me like this kind of in the ether. And I thought he really fucking nailed it. It's like newfound respect for you, dude.
He does a combination of dropping some truth and also coming off like a completely arrogant asshole.
Totally. And that's the thing. Like, whenever I hear him talk, I always think you come across as an arrogant bastard, but you know, he's pretty much in tune with the thing. And I think it's also worth noting that one of the things that always kind of irked me and still irks me, maybe not as much anymore because it's not as prevalent anymore, was the fact that for a long time it was, if you had one woman on your lineup, you were like safe. And this was, hearing Jewel talk about this was kind of amazing. Kind of,
they did that here where they basically had 3 days of festival and one woman
were not each day
on each of the 3 days.
And then I thought, then why would you say yes? If you knew this was going to be a problem, just say no.
I'm not sure they knew what the lineup was.
But yeah, I expect not.
To it. And so you see like the audience really not responding to Alanis Morissette.
And like, at the height of her career at that point.
Yeah. And you know, they just wanted to, the audience that was there, they just wanted to get to like Limp Bizkit.
So all of this to say the 90s were weird and Woodstock 99 is definitely worth checking out.
Yes, it is a, it can be a frustrating documentary to watch, but in all the best ways. And I think it's an important documentary to watch. I think this doc, more than any other doc, really kind of captures what the zeitgeist was at the end of the 90s.
I fully agree 110%. Yeah.
And I think it also sort of creates a little bit of a North Star to like contextualize how we got where we are today.
For sure. And, you know, I think the more I've been thinking about it, because I did watch this a couple of weeks ago as well, and it's been kind of percolating in the back of my mind. We're kind of reliving, maybe not to the same extent, but I kind of feel, I can't help but feel that we're kind of reliving something similar, but this time with movie culture and the way that it's kind of, it's following many of the same steps. And I don't think it's ever going to explode the way that Woodstock did, but it kind of feels like at some point the pressure cooker is going to blow up.
Yeah. Well, we had like in the game industry recently, we had massive lawsuit come out against Blizzard and a lot of really horrible stories that have come out of that studio and the kind of like rampant sexist culture that exists inside that game studio from the top down. And it's really hard to look at that and go, you know what? How many of those dudes were at Woodstock 99? And even if they weren't there, they sort of like, they would have been like,
they're of that age group
of age where they came out of that culture.
Yeah.
And you see what that culture is in Woodstock 99. And now they're at the game studio and they're creating the culture there.
It percolates.
It's really not hard to draw a direct line.
No, not at all. So watch it, people. It's worth looking out for.
Absolutely.
On a different note, Jolt.
Yes. Jolt, have you watched this?
We did. We watched this like last weekend.
Okay, I want to hear your thoughts.
I kind of fucking love this movie, even though I probably shouldn't.
Me too.
I had this conversation with somebody else the other day. We were talking about female-led action movies written and directed by men that kind of all feel the same and they all have the same motivations. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, yeah, that's true. But once in a while you get one that's actually like lots of fun. Fuck, this is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Like on a level that I wasn't expecting. And goddamn, I love Kate Beckinsale in these movies. Just give her all of them. I don't care. I'll keep watching them. She's so good.
Yeah.
I love so much about this movie.
She's got this down. Although a particular Jolt, not directed by a man, directed by a woman, Tanya Wexler.
Yeah, who I love. And I, this is so different from her previous movies. Yeah,
and she does mostly like rom-com stuff and like romantic drama type films. And so this is very much outside of her regular wheelhouse.
Very much so.
Knocks it out of the park.
Totally. I really like her style of filmmaking, but this was a bit of a shock to the system.
Yeah.
It's so well put together. I really didn't see the ending coming, which is surprising. But then I was so invested in the movie that I wasn't paying attention to a lot of the details. But man, there's a joy about this movie that I just can't get over. Yeah.
Well, and the premise is so fun too.
Yes.
You have Kate Beckinsale, who is this woman who has grown up with this debilitating condition where she basically can stop the rage inside of her. It's like an actual like chemical process that, you know, she will just like fly into a rage and start like, you know, beating people within an inch of her life. And this starts from a very young age and has completely fucked her life as a result of it. She cannot function in society as a result. And she is currently the recipient of some experimental technology where basically every time she feels like it's coming on, she presses a little button and basically shocks herself with a shock harness to basically keep herself under control.
And can we say that this is all explained during the opening credits?
Yeah.
With no dialogue.
Yeah. We get a very rapid fire explanation of this. And the film opens with her basically going on a blind date with Jai Courtney, of all people.
With funny glasses that makes him look older.
Yeah, who is very not recognizable in this movie. It's like, I got halfway through this movie before I realized, oh shit, that's Jai Courtney.
I had to look it up. I'm like, that totally looks like him. Is it him?
Yeah.
Can we note that he's also much younger than her, which I think is tops?
Yeah. Normally he's got a very distinctive voice, but it took me a bit to clock that it was actually him in this movie. And so she goes on a blind date with him just to see if she can try to, like, have a normal date without blowing up. And it sort of doesn't go well, but he's, you know, smitten with her and persists. And, you know, it's like he basically becomes, like, her manic pixie dream girl. And they have a relationship. And then it turns out that he's, like, an accountant for Bobsters, and he gets killed. And all of a sudden, she is off the chain and wants to get revenge for the death of the only person who has treated her nice in her entire life. So it's a very kind of like standard plot from there. But one thing that is so fun about this movie is the approach of both the writing and Kate Beckinsale to this film, where she is going at it not with this level of kind of like pathos and nihilism on this revenge quest, but more just like a, I'm going to have fun with this. I don't care what happens to me, but I'm going to have a laugh if I'm going to go out this way. And so she's like, has this incredible, like, devil may care attitude that wears so well on her. And as she just basically like burns her way through the underworld to try to get to the guy responsible for this. And it is so much fun. I had a laugh. You. It's like what I said was that this movie is absolute total trash, but this is my trash.
I'm with you.
It's exactly the trash that I love.
I'm with
and
you.
I want more of this trash.
I'm with you 150%. Give me more. I'm in. And Stanley Tucci is kind of perfect.
Yes. Yes. In the only role that apparently Stanley Tucci can play now, which is like the doctor guy that helps the hero go on their quest.
Which is funny.
He's physician mentor. That's his role now.
Yeah, that and food guru on CNN. So hey, whatever works. Whatever works, man. I'm good.
And you know, I will never say no to more Stanley Tucci.
Ditto.
Oh, the tooch is always welcome.
So yes, people see Jolt. Give it a shot. It's just so ridiculous. Fun.
I think a lot of people have kind of sort of just like passed by the movie or written it off or whatnot.
I know.
It look interesting. It's on Amazon Prime. It is so much fun.
I agree.
Definitely worth a watch.
I agree 110% because I had totally skipped it. And then I was like, we need something that's not so depressing. So like, let's watch this. And it was total.
And Kate Beckinsale is like, she's doing her underworld thing. You know, she's like, I'm kick-ass action hero woman. But God damn it, if I don't love that every time.
I mean,
I don't care what it is.
Yeah, I'm in. Okay, her Instagram is kind of genius.
Is it?
If you don't follow her on Instagram, she is kind of... The attitude she displays here, I think is kind of just her. Because it comes across on her Instagram as well. It's rather like... It's pictures of her doing weird things and then her dogs. It's kind of amazing.
Nice.
I'm really glad you discovered Mythic Quest. Because
yes,
I kind of love this show. I love this show on a level that is unprecedented. I really, really like this show a lot.
So they gave me, with the PlayStation 5, they started handing out 6-month free subscriptions to Apple TV Plus.
So
I picked up an Apple TV Plus subscription. Why not? It was free.
Yeah.
And I started watching some of the stuff that was on there that, you know, that I've either wanted to see or has gone under the radar. And I finally watched Mythic Quest, which is a show I'd heard mixed things about. I'm like, okay, it's interesting. And I find it kind of interesting that like Ubisoft has sort of dove into doing film and TV production. This is an Ubisoft production. And one of the first things they do is a show about a horribly run game company. From a studio that also has some very unsettling allegations that have come out of it in the last few years. It's like, maybe there's a little bit of autobiography here that shouldn't be here. I don't know. But this is, it's from a bunch of the people who are responsible for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So you have Rob McElhenney, who's co-creator of the show and also star of the show, and Charlie Day on there as well. and also Megan Gantz as creating the show. And it's basically just all about a small game studio that was started by this one incredibly narcissistic dude who all they do is this one MMO game called Mythic Quest. And it is basically just, it's a workplace comedy. It's a HR's worst nightmare workplace comedy, where it's a creative industry of a bunch of incredibly skilled and emotionally stunted people all thrown together in this melting pot and constantly clashing. And it is both taking shots at things in the video game industry, but also just working in any creative industry in general. I mean, I work in TV, and I saw a lot of parallels between this game studio and TV. So I was able to get a lot of entertainment out of it that way. But the show is a lot of fun, even if it is sometimes a little bit inconsistent. And sometimes there were a few plot lines where I'm like, ooh, that's a bit uncomfortable. But I did still really enjoy the show. And it's, I think it's definitely worth watching.
I love Poppy. I have a passion for Poppy. She's fabulous. And I'm still not 100% sure if she is stunted or if she just pretends to be. I still haven't. I think she walks the fine line, which I think is really interesting. But yeah, there's so much about the show that I really, really like. I think you're right. Sometimes it does walk that line of, is this okay? I'm not 100% sure, but I think that that's on purpose. And I've never seen it. Yeah. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but I've always heard that it's a really good show that also kind of, it can be uncomfortable at times. So I expect that this is maybe in the same wheelhouse, but I don't know. There's a couple of episodes here that I just think are so genius. Like the pandemic episode I thought was fantastic. The cosplay episode that they have, I think, is like hilarious. I don't know. I love the show so much. I don't watch a lot of comedies, so that could also play into that. But
well, and one of the things that I particularly loved is Danny Pudi in this show, who you remember as Abed from Community, and his character on this show could not be a more polar opposite of his character from Community. And it's really neat getting to see that actor sort of like stretch in that way and play like completely different characters, because he is a right horrible bastard in this show. And he plays, God, what is even his title? But he's basically like marketing at the video game company. So he's basically the dude who comes in and says, yes, this fun creative thing you made is great, but what if we just put in a bunch of loot boxes in and charge people too much money? That's who he is.
Yeah.
That's his role. So he's the guy who the only thing he cares about is money and just like dominating other people in a business sense and demoralizing everyone. And it's just, he's having so much fun in this role. It is pretty great.
No, it's pretty awesome. Mythic Quest, recommended.
Yeah, definitely worth a watch. Get like 3 episodes in. You'll learn very quickly whether or not
you're going to like it or not. Exactly. Yeah. What else we got? Oh, okay. I haven't seen this yet, but I'm curious to get your take on Brand New Cherry Flavor.
Yeah, so this is a new show that just dropped on Netflix. I hadn't heard anything about it, and then it just appeared, and I'm like, whoa, what is this? I have to watch this. So it is basically a horror series on Netflix starring Rosa Salazar, which is from the creators of Channel Zero, the creepypasta horror show that was on Shudder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and this is basically it is based on a novel, and it's a story about a young woman in the 90s moving to LA to pursue her career of being a filmmaker, and she's made this short that got her some attention, and she immediately meets up with this big time but somewhat washed out producer who ends up screwing her over and stealing her movie from her. And so she goes to Catherine Keener, which is living in the Hollywood Hills, to basically put a curse on him and destroy his life. And she has to like jump through all of these like weird, you know, like mysticism hoops to basically like put this curse on him. And it's like the only thing she dedicated to at this point. And she goes on this really trippy and bizarre and almost David Lynchian kind of journey in her quest to sort of get revenge against this producer. And it is such a fun show. It is disturbing in the ways you want it to be disturbing. It's fun in the ways you want it to be fun. It has that whole kind of like, there's something that's just bizarre and weird around every corner in LA sort of vibe to it that you get with like some kind. It sort of reminds me of that movie, was it Under the Silver Lake?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, where whether or not you like that movie, it has that same sort of like, you're going from bizarre situation to bizarre situation sort of vibe to it. In, you know, a picturesque place with palm trees and, you know, beautiful women. And it's like, it's, I'm really digging the show. I'm only about 2 episodes into it so far. There's 8 episodes in total, but I'm definitely going to keep with the show and keep watching it. And it's a lot of fun. I do recommend it.
Nice. I actually did watch the trailer the other day. I was like, oh, this looks fun. So I've added it to my watch list. I will get to it.
Watch anything with Rosa Salazar. She is in Alita Battle Angel, and she was also in a series called Undone, which is on Prime, which is a really cool show. If anyone hasn't seen that, go back and watch that, because it is this show all about this girl who loses her father, played by Bob Odenkirk. And he kind of like starts visiting her as an apparition and explaining to her that she actually genetically has the power to control space and time, as he tries to like train her how to do that. And she starts like just kind of like randomly bouncing through time in her life and like losing track of like what is where and what is happening and struggle with that. And the entire show, it's from the creators of BoJack Horseman, and the entire show is animated, but it was like, it's like one of those one of Richard Linklater's movies where the whole thing was like filmed and then rotoscoped over top. And so it's really interesting style and a really interesting story. So if you haven't seen that, go back and look. That's on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
I think it's like 8 episodes in total, and it's getting a second season.
Oh, nice. I hadn't even heard of that. I'm adding that to my list.
That one slipped by too many people's radar. So there's a Rosa Salazar twofer for you.
Nice. I like Alita Battle Angel, so that just me. Okay, The Night Comes for Us. What is this thing?
So this one is a little bit older. I think it's about a year old at this point, but I finally went back and watched it. It is martial arts film, I believe Indonesian martial arts film from, I'm going to butcher the name, but Timo Tajanto. And it stars Iko Uwais and Joe Taslim. Basically, this is how to describe this movie. So it's really simple, where basically there's Joe Taslim is a dude who is working for the triad, and they murder a whole bunch of, it opens with a mass murder of a whole bunch of people in a small village, and there's like one girl who's still alive, and he basically decides to gun down all his brothers and then take the little girl and, you know, run with her. And so now it's like there's a price on his head, and the triad is coming after him. He's pissed off the wrong people, and the whole thing is basically him and his friends basically doing like a last stand to try to fend off this horde that is coming to murder them to protect this little girl. And this is potentially, okay, so I don't understand people who enjoy this movie but say that they don't like horror movies. Because this is as gory and graphic as about 8 Saw films.
Oh, jeez.
This movie is incredibly nihilistic, incredibly dark, incredibly humorless, very violent, very graphic. And I love the ever-loving shit out of it. It was so good. Like every time you feel like one of these movies has nothing new to show you, this movie basically comes up and takes a bag full of billiard balls and knocks the teeth out of your mouth to show you that, no, it hasn't all been done before. Wow. There's some incredibly fun, creative stuff in this movie, and it is so brutal. This is a hard watch. There are people I know who love martial arts movies and are good with horror movies, and even they noped out of this movie.
Whoa.
So, you know, you've been warned. But if you're vibing on what this movie is doing, it is a wild ride.
I looked it up because I'm like, do I even remember this? I don't even remember seeing this come out.
It's a Netflix movie, so it's on Netflix. I think they bought it and did like an original Netflix movie release of it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. When I'm feeling the right mood, I might have to give this a go.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. I liked it.
Okay. I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name, so I'm going to massacre it. Garth Marenghi? His name? I don't even know. Dark Place? Tell me about this. Where did this even come from? Because it's not even new.
Okay, no, it is not new. This is a thing that I've been hearing about for years, and I finally watched. So here was the Oedipus that all over Twitter, I kept seeing people say, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place is now on Amazon Prime, so you have no excuse to not watch this thing. And so I was like, okay, I've been hearing about this thing for years. I'm finally going to watch it. It's an old British show. And then I go on Amazon Prime and I discover, oh, apparently not in Canada, only in the US. And I got disappointed. And then someone pointed to me on Twitter and said, by the way, the entire thing's on YouTube. So I went to YouTube, and yes, all 6 episodes of the show, it's only 6 episodes long because it's a British series, are up there, so I watched it there. This is such an interesting show. The premise is basically Garth Marenghi, who is a fictional person, played by Matthew Holness, is a hack horror writer in the 80s who has written a bunch of shitty horror paperback novels. He's like a Dean R. Koontz type of person. But it's like also convinced of like his absolute brilliance as a writer. And in the 80s had produced, written, and directed a TV series called Dark Place, which has never been seen because no one would air it because it was so bad. And he's decided, now I am going to present to you, the public, you're going to get to see from the annals of history, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. And every episode is like prefaced with like a Ray Bradbury theater introduction from him, basically like waxing poetic on his own brilliance about where his story ideas come from. And then the episodes will be interspersed with interviews between him sitting in a studio talking about what you're watching, basically like a retrospective, and his publisher, played by Richard Ayoade, who you might know from the IT Crowd. And in between there is the actual show, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which is basically like this supernatural hospital drama. It all takes place in a hospital where he's like this brilliant doctor who everyone respects, but it's also an occultist and weird things keep happening. And
this explains the still that I saw, which had everybody in scrubs holding guns, kind of like, yes. Charlie's Angels style. And I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's like the show within the show. And then the show within the show is so poorly made, but it's poorly made on a level that I have never seen before, where there are so many gags in there. Some of them are obvious and some of them are less obvious. And they're type of gag that, having worked on a lot of independent films and seen when things go wrong and how they go wrong, they do a lot of that stuff there that people might not pick up. like shots that just have an uncomfortable amount of headroom in them. There's one shot where you can literally see like shadows of lighting gear in the background. Like the elevator doors close and you can see like the shadow of a light stand on the elevator doors. It's like, wait a minute. And it's like the very first opening scene, you have a woman walks into the hospital and it's supposed to be like a cat walks out in front of her. It's supposed to be what happens. But the cat just basically gets like tossed out a doorway and lands in front of her. And even though you can't see the person who's just inside the doorway that tossed the cat, you can tell that there's someone just standing right there who tossed the cat. And you're like, wait a minute, that's not how that's supposed to be. That wasn't what they were going for. And like, there's one part where it's the joke is basically that they finish the episode and realize that it didn't make any sense. And so there's a literal 40-second ADR explanation that occurs. And because they did not have footage to support it, it's literally just cutting back and forth to different objects of B-roll in the office. So you're looking at a plant, you're looking at the phone, you're looking at a wall, a painting on the wall. And it's cutting back and forth between these as you get this obviously poorly mixed ADR of him quickly rambling off what the entire explanation of what you just watched was. And it's a level of layered comedy of bad writing, bad filmmaking, and him playing this hack horror writer reflecting fondly on what they made. That was so entertaining. And also young Matt Berry, who you might recognize from What We Do in the Shadows, the TV series, is in this. And he has just always been hilarious as well.
How long are these episodes? I'm curious.
They're like they're a half hour long. It's six episodes. So you can burn through this in 3 hours. It's very entertaining to watch. I highly recommend it.
Okay, well, I'm definitely going to add this to my list because Dan and I just watched both seasons of Staged, which we hadn't seen before. So this was the BBC production with Michael Sheen and David Tennant, where basically it was done during lockdown. It is basically Michael Sheen and David Tennant have agreed to be in a play. And the director has brilliantly figured out that the way to proceed is, even though they can't meet in person to rehearse, they will rehearse online so that when the theaters open up, they will be ahead of everybody else and they'll be able to get going faster than everyone else. And of course, Michael Sheen thinks this entire thing is a big mistake. And David Tennant is friends with the director and he's kind of talked Michael Sheen into doing this thing. So the entire first season is basically them agreeing to finally do this. And then the whole thing kind of like starts to fall apart almost immediately. And it's just this collection of the actors are playing extensions of themselves. Their wives are on the show. Their kids are on the show, at least indirectly. So it's everybody kind of playing a hyped up version of themselves. And this continues into season two. It is the funniest thing ever. And Michael Sheen is on another level of crazy. He's got the giant hair and the big beard. And it's just kind of amazing. I really, really, we really thoroughly enjoyed the show. And it's on demand. In Canada, it's on demand on one of the movie channels, which I can't remember right now. But so you can easily find it. I don't know. I have no idea where it's playing in the States. But it's only like 5 episodes in season 1 and 8 episodes in season 2. And season 2 takes it to another level because they're remaking so they've recorded these. So like it's very meta because they're practicing for this play, but it turns out that the practice has now become its own thing. And so they want to remake it for an American audience, but they don't want to cast David Tennant and Michael Sheen because they're not big enough. So they want to recast with real movie stars. And this whole second season is this hilarious series of interviews between Michael Tennant and David Sheen. And I keep mixing up their names, but it's basically they're meeting with people that are going to replace them in the American version and giving notes on the performance. God. And it's just the level of meta in this thing is just on another level. It's just very, very funny. So I highly recommend searching it out. It's very short and just hilarious. And yeah, those two going at each other, it's pretty funny.
That definitely sounds like it vibes with this.
Yeah, very much. It feels like it's in the same wheelhouse, so I'm definitely going to be checking out Dark Place because we just finished that yesterday and we're like, well, what else can we watch? So this will be our
watch one episode of it. It's really easy to tell. I went into it like super skeptical because it's one of those things that like people had built up so much. The biggest thing that I knew about it for the longest time was this meme that would go around Twitter every once in a while, which was this. And I never knew where it came from, but it was like one of the clips of Gareth Marenghi doing like the in-studio interview, you know, from the show. And he has this quote where he says, "I know writers that use subtext and they're all cowards." And every once in a while that would go around Twitter. And it's like, that's an amazing fucking quote. And where did this come from? And apparently it came from this. And people just constantly talk about this show, and it's like, okay, this has been hyped up so much, there's no way the show could be that good. And it's also like, it sort of touches in this thing that I have problems with sometimes with like insincere filmmaking, like purposely bad filmmaking usually doesn't work for me. Like the Sharknados of the world do nothing for me. So I was very skeptical going in, but like 5 minutes into the show, I was like, yeah, no, I'm hooked.
No.
And it's like, you'll know very quickly whether this is your jam or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm with you. I can't watch bad movies for the sake. Like, don't give me a Sharknado because I just have no interest.
Yeah.
Not for me.
Yeah. I'd rather watch a sincerely made bad movie than an insincerely made bad movie that's supposed to be funny for being bad.
Yeah. Agreed. I also watched a couple of more things. I watched Val, the documentary on Val Kilmer, which is now streaming.
I've not seen it yet.
Yeah, this is now streaming on Amazon Prime. I've always kind of felt that I never really understood Val Kilmer. He always comes across as this very aloof, larger than life, thinks he's better than everybody else kind of character. And mm-hmm. I mean, but I don't know. I don't have that sort of relationship with actors. So to me, he's just been like, he's another guy. He just happens to be full of himself. This is interesting because the documentary, it's not specific. It's not really made by him. It's not directed by him, but it features all of his personal footage. He's had a video camera from like before time, and he's been filming himself since he was a kid. And so the documentary is really, really interesting because it's a combination of, he can't speak now because he had throat cancer. So he speaks very awkwardly. And you can tell he's, towards the end of the documentary, it becomes more natural and he feels more comfortable speaking in his own voice. But for a large part of it, his son is reading voiceover that he has written. And it's just a really fascinating picture of an actor that whose career has never really been what he wanted it to be. Like he's a classically trained theater actor. He wanted to be a theater actor. He kind of fell into movies as a way to, you know, pay bills. And it's that kind of became his career, but it's never been what he really wants to do. And he comes to every role with this very theatrical approach that doesn't always work well. And it's over the course of his career, it's really made him kind of this misunderstood, larger than life, often like classified as a difficult guy to work with. And so this is just a really interesting, very introspective look at an actor through his own, like through his own eyes and through his own voice. And it's just a really fascinating movie about, you know, acting. I really enjoyed it. I think it shines a really interesting light and unfolds a few layers of Val Kilmer that I didn't have before. I have some new appreciation for the kind of actor that he is. It's just a really interesting picture of a guy who kind of just fell into this career. It's quite good. I really thoroughly enjoy it.
I think the only reason I haven't watched it yet, and I will watch it at some point, but I think the only reason I haven't watched it yet is I haven't really kind of fully reconciled with the fact that I can't remember to what degree, but Val was obviously involved in the making of this documentary, which sort of, I don't want to say ethical considerations, but at the same time, it's like, okay, at a certain point, is it, how much of it is a documentary and how much of it is just like PR for the dude?
Oh yeah, no, it totally is. It totally, totally is, because it does. I mean, I am the result of this documentary. Like, I'm exactly the kind of person that he wants, because he's clearly for a long time been sort of considered like as this difficult guy to work with and perhaps not the best actor. And this is very much like clean the image kind of thing, but it feels very sincere. And as long as you can kind of see that, and I mean, it's on full display, they're not hiding it. He clearly, like the footage is all footage that he's given up, and it's clearly edited to show him in a very specific light. And I mean, he's very involved. He's in a lot of the documentary. He talks a lot about his career. So, I mean, as long as you can kind of see that, like, they're not hiding it in any way, shape, or form. So it is very much, I think you're totally right, it's very much a clean the image kind of documentary, and it really works effectively to that degree, to that end. And it's hard not to, I don't know, maybe because I've never really been like a big like movie star kind of person. Like, I don't follow people's careers in that way. Like, I don't care about their personal lives per se. Like, I knew something had happened to him, which is why he hadn't been in movies in a while. I didn't realize he'd had cancer until I watched the documentary. So I mean, for me, not knowing anything about his personal life, it was kind of interesting just to get a sense of who he sees himself as. I think as long as you kind of keep that in mind, I think the documentary is definitely worth it, because he certainly sees himself in a different light than we see him from the outside. And I think that there's value in both. I think there is something to the fact that he comes across as a difficult person to work with, because he actually is a difficult person to work with, because that's just the kind of actor that he is. It's really interesting. And it's interesting when you go back then and watch some of the movies that he's been in, because just out of like sheer, like, it just happened that we watched Top Gun like a few days after I'd seen this, and I'm like, okay, I kind of get a new appreciation for this now. Not to say that and it's funny, because the other day we were flipping through the TV and The Doors was on, and he had talked a little bit about that in the documentary. I'm like, is this on purpose? Or it's just sheer coincidence, but it's worth checking out, I think.
Yeah, I had known about his condition a few years ago, where I saw it's like a retrospective Q&A for the movie Heat. They had like a ton of the people involved. I think Christopher Nolan was interviewing Michael Mann on stage about it.
Oh wow!
And like asking questions of everyone about it. And it was really interesting. And Val Kilmer was there. And I had heard that he had had some problems. And then I see he shows up and it's like he is struggling to talk. And everyone's sort of giving him the space to take as much time as he needs to, you know, say what he needs to say. And it's like, it's impossible to not feel for the dude when you see that. It's like, it's incredibly unfortunate. And then he did, shortly after that, he did the movie The Snowman, which, you know, is a completely failed movie on every level for so many different reasons. But also, like, Val's in there and they end up just like completely dubbing him with someone else's voice, and it's very awkward.
One of the things that I thought was most interesting was there's a section of the documentary where you see him at fan conventions, and he talks very candidly about that and the spin that he makes on, you know, the fan experience and why he's doing that is super interesting to see that from the perspective of an actor that maybe is no longer at his prime, maybe was never really at his prime, is really, really fascinating. I just thought it was a really interesting character observation, especially considering that it's so much of it is from his perspective. It's a fascinating watch. I recommend it. Misha and the Wolves, another weird-ass documentary. Weird-ass documentary. So this is on Netflix. It's about Misha de Fonseca, who is a Holocaust survivor who at some point in, I think it was either the late 90s or early 2000s, she had told the story of her survival of the Holocaust as a young girl who ran away from her foster family, basically, and traveled through the backwards from Brussels, I think, to Berlin in search of her parents who had been taken by the Nazis and put into a concentration camp. And then, so this is how the story starts. And so, you know, she tells this story at a synagogue. And then somebody's like, well, this is a fantastical story. You need to share this story of miraculous, you know, rescue and whatever. And so she writes a book that kind of doesn't go anywhere, but kind of gets a little bit of attention, was almost an Oprah's book club pick. And then shit started to go sideways. And they, in the end, it turns out that maybe her story isn't really true, but maybe it is. The documentary takes so many different twists and turns. It's totally fascinating. I don't want to say too much because I was certainly like shocked by what I discovered. Worth checking out for sure. And this was big news at the time when it was unfolding, but I mean, I hadn't seen anything about it. I don't know how many people will have recognized the story, but it's just worth watching. There's just so much weirdness that surrounds this. It's just, it's so fascinating. Highly recommended by me.
I will check that out.
The Half of It, which is also streaming on Netflix. I can't believe I missed this because this is totally a Marina movie. It's directed by Alice Wu and it stars Leah Lewis as Ellie Chu, who is this very bright high school student who makes money on the side by selling paper to other high school students. You later learn that she lives with her dad who works he's like a technician for the railway company. And then you get the whole backstory of how he's ended up here. And it's a story really about, it's a coming of age story about a young girl finding herself in the world. And it's just, no, it doesn't follow the typical high school movie coming of age tropes. And it's just genuinely just a very sweet movie. It's not even really a romance. It kind of is, but it's not, I don't know. It just, it hits a lot of the high points for me. And it's really well made. And Leah Lewis is super charming. I cannot wait to see her in more stuff. So recommended. I can't believe this totally flew under my radar. So I assume it probably flew under a lot of people's radar. But definitely worth checking out. I don't know if you remember this. It's from 2016. It's a few years old now. It's J.D. Dillard's movie with Jacob Lattimore. It was about the big thing about when it was coming out. It's about a young guy who's like a magician, who's also like a drug dealer and like shit happens. It is a bunch of movies that you don't really expect all crammed together because it's a drug dealer movie, but not really. It's a magic movie, but not really. It's a coming of age story, but not really, or maybe more than that. It's produced by WWE Studios, which I still have not figured out how they became involved. But I will say this, if they could keep making movies like this, life would be much, much better. It's not.
Well, I could be wrong, but I think WWE Studios is no more.
Oh, well, to make matters worse, this is one of the good ones that they made then. It's not without its problems, but it's a really fascinating story. And it's very uncommon. Like, you just don't see movies like this all the time. It's kind of like all these little things married together. And it really does work. I don't know. I have some issues with it, but generally speaking, I thought it was really well done. And I just wish there were more movies like this, movies that are really unexpected. You think you're going in for one thing and it turns out to be something completely unexpected. And at every turn, like, this was showing me something that I really wasn't expecting. And Jacob Lattimore, I haven't seen him in anything since this. Apparently he's on TV as well. I guess I don't watch any of the shows that he's on, but he's really, really solid here. I really enjoyed it. Worth watching, I think.
Sorry, I just looked it up real quick. Yeah. And I just want to amend what I said. Apparently WWE Studios is still a thing, but they have definitely kind of slowed down / changed direction. Like 2017, which Slight is from, they produced, what, 7 movies that year? And then now they're at a point where, like, 2019, they did one movie, which was Fighting With My Family. And then 2020, they did one movie. And then the only thing they've got past that is there's a film in pre-production for 2022, which is an animated film. Oh. So they've definitely slowed down the film production.
And see, and I don't know how many of them I've seen because I don't really keep track of who's producing what for the most part, but I've always just assumed that WWE is producing movies with their
that's what they do. Like 80% of what they do is like, okay, here's a way for us to capitalize on the success of our wrestlers, and wrestlers seem to make because wrestling, so much of wrestling is acting, they seem to make an actually genuinely good transition into filmmaking. We've got The Rock, we've got John Cena, you know, CM Punk has been doing a whole bunch of little horror movies, you know, Dave Bautista. It seems to be like a natural progression for wrestlers to sort of age out of wrestling and come into acting. And WWE being what WWE is, the, you know, monopolistic corporation that it is, it's like, we're going to capitalize on this and we're going to start to like make films with our staple of wrestlers. And that's what 70% of the films they make are. It's just a way for them to capitalize on that. But they also, on the side of that, will also produce like genuine movies that have no wrestlers attached to them at all. So it's kind of wild. It's been hard to put a beat on like exactly what their focus is.
Yeah. Well, you know, keep doing it, I guess. Whatever works for you, man. I really liked Slight. I thought it was definitely unexpected for me. I thought I knew what I was going into, and it was not what I expected at all. We watched Tom McCarthy's Stillwater, which is now available on VOD after having played theatrical for, I think, like a month. This is the Matt Damon movie that's kind of like the Amanda Knox story, but maybe not really. It's really well done. I mean, McCarthy makes really good movies. This is not like an action-packed thriller. It's very much a drama with a capital D, with Matt Damon as this all-American guy with a dark, troubled past who goes to France to try to rescue his daughter, who's been in prison for 5 years already for having apparently killed her lover. And maybe she did it or maybe she didn't. It's very gray. It's just a really solid drama. I don't know, like Damon is great. It has a very like non-American flavor because it is all set in France for the most part. And it does feel like this guy just at every turn is just fucking things up and he just cannot get anything right. And there's some interesting turns here that I wasn't really expecting. It's really good, and it plays really well. It's quite long. It's over 2 hours long, but it really makes great use of the time. Dan and I both really, really liked it. I wasn't quite sure if he was gonna go for it because it is not an action movie decidedly, and yeah, we both really, really liked it. Damon is great, like really good in this. So I would say definitely worth checking out. And then the last thing that we caught was Lisa Joy's Reminiscence, which just came out with Hugh Jackman. This movie kind of came out of nowhere. I saw ads for it at the beginning of the week and come Friday. It's like, oh, here's this new movie you can watch. I'm like, okay. I wasn't quite sure what to expect because the trailer didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But I'm like, well, co-creator of Westworld, this might be interesting. The script was apparently on the blacklist in 2013. It's been kicking around for a while. And it's her directorial debut and it shows. Like, it's a really interesting concept that never quite... It really needs somebody with more vision and more knowledge to really bring it to life. It just kind of feels very flat. So the concept here is that we're in a futuristic world that's kind of Blade Runner-ish, though not quite as dystopic, where wars have happened, flooding has happened, half the cities are underwater. Hugh Jackman runs this operation where you can basically relive your thoughts, like you can relive moments in your life, and they used to use it for militaristic research, and now he's doing it kind of so people can relive, you know, their past great moments, or if they're really rich, they can relive it to find out where they left their car keys. It's kind of, it's a great concept, but it doesn't really work. It turns out to be this noir. Rebecca Ferguson is in it as a love interest. Thandi Newton is in it as, I don't know exactly what her role is, but I wish it came together better. It just doesn't really work on any level. It's kind of just like this boring, draggy movie with some really not great voiceover explaining things. Oh, yeah, no. It's a miss for Hugh Jackman for sure. It doesn't even look particularly great. Like, the idea of the universe is really interesting and it never quite materializes. It just really needed somebody else to put it together. I think that there's a story there. It's just not this one. So disappointing, I'd say skip it. And that's,
well, that's disappointing.
Yeah. I'll end there. I should have maybe ended with Stillwater, which I really like, rather than ending on a downer note. Sorry.
Well, we gave you plenty of things.
There are plenty of things, yeah.
That are awesome to watch.
Mm-hmm. So. For sure. For sure. And festival season is about to start.
Yes.
I'm super excited. Super excited. I'm very much looking forward.
I've got a few things still that I'm going to see at Fantasia.
I haven't watched anything at Fantasia. I did make an effort last year, and I was rather disappointed with by what I did watch. And I looked at the lineup this year, and I'm like, am I going to have
I got some free passes through the Canadian Cinema Editors Guild.
So. Oh, nice. And, yeah, because I did.
I'm going to take advantage of that and see some movies. So I'm going to see the new Sion Sono.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I'm going to be seeing that.
Okay, I will report. We'll have to report back on that because I'm going to be seeing that shortly as well. And I haven't looked at anything else at Fantasia, but I know TIFF is coming up, and I've already checked out some of the stuff that they're going to be having that I'm interested in. So it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks for sure. Lots of fun stuff coming. And then when does Fantasia end? It's coming up soon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's already ongoing right now, Fantasia.
Yeah.
So it's been going on since the beginning of the month, and I think it's going to be wrapping up at the end of the month shortly. So
yeah. All right.
So it's almost over.
So we will link to all the things we talked about today so that you can catch up on some of it, hopefully all of it, because there's lots of good stuff. If you want to find us, where can people find you?
You can find me on the Twitters. I'm at Ashley Lynch.
I am also on the Twitters, so not as often. I'm the Marina. I think you're probably better off finding me on Letterboxd because I've actually been trying to update that more regularly. I usually keep like a pen and paper list, and then when I have time, I will do a huge dump of reviews. And then I'm like, do I ever even remember this movie? So I'm trying to be more active at, you know, more timely reviewing stuff. And I've been trying to be more active on Twitter. It's going okay, I guess.
I've been trying to do more on my Letterboxd as well, too. So
yes, find us on Letterboxd, people. It's the same. Is it still at Ashley Lynch?
I believe so. I'm not sure what the at system on Letterboxd is. No, but yeah, I'm Ashley Lynch on there.
And I'm Marina Antunes. So just search for us. I'll link to it in the show notes. You don't even have to remember. And then come on by etcpod.ca to check out those show notes. And we'll talk to you guys on the other side.
See you next time.
Opening and closing credits are Happy Alley by composer Kevin MacLeod. For more information, visit incompetech.com.